I want to continue telling the story of how the King James Bible came to be for a few moments this evening. Last time we talked about the rise of the Protestant Reformation, particularly during King Henry VIII's reign. And after Henry VIII, Mary of Tudor came to the throne of England, and she was a persecutor of the Protestants. She is known by the epithet Bloody Mary and was responsible for the martyrdom of many Protestant people during the first part of the 16th century. And after Mary of Tudor, Elizabeth I came to the throne, and she restored the role of Protestantism. She opened the way for those who were not amenable to the Roman Catholic vein of thinking to have freedom of worship. And she is known as Good Queen Bess in history. Elizabeth I's reign was marked as a golden age in English history. And we're telling the story now of the monarch immediately preceding King James, who came to the throne in the year 1603 upon the death of Queen Elizabeth. But I want to talk for just a moment about why her reign was so significant in what came to be as the production of the King James Bible. During her reign, England grew to its most powerful, and it really established a national identity for the first time in its history. Again, she was inclined toward the Protestants. Mary before her had been inclined toward the Catholics. So when Queen Elizabeth came to the throne, Protestants breathed a sigh of relief. And there was a significant military victory that took place, and perhaps you've heard this story. I want to briefly recount it for you. In 1588, which was a great boon to Protestantism, the Spanish Armada was deployed under Philip II from Portugal in May of 1588. He deployed 130 ships of the Spanish fleet to go to England with the plan of action to invade England, to cross the English Channel, to invade England from the south, and to restore Roman Catholicism in England. So this was while Queen Elizabeth was on the throne. He intended to sweep the seas around the British Isles and permit the Duke of Parma to cross the channel with an army to invade England. On July the 19th, the Spanish fleet was spotted by the English Navy off the coast of the Lizard, which is at the western entrance of the English Channel. And the English fleet put several ships out to sea, and they shadowed the Spanish Armada upwind for a period of several days. At midnight on July the 28th, the English commander set 8 ships on fire, and they were called fire ships. And he sent them downwind toward the Spanish Armada. And the Armada was in a flanking position, or they were in this position that had been popularized by Philip of Macedon, the phalanx position. And the English fire ships were headed right toward them. Well, as they saw these floating fireballs coming down the channel toward them, some of the captains panicked of the Spanish Armada, and they cut the guide wire to their anchors. And the Spanish fleet was basically scattered. And the Spanish commander, in the aftermath of that, which the fire ships really didn't cause a lot of damage, except it scattered what was a tight-knit Spanish fleet. And in the aftermath of that, the Spanish commander attempted to reform the ships that were scattered, but an unusually strong western wind prevented the plan. Only a dozen or so ships were able to gather and to anchor of the 130. And while they remained at anchor at Gravelines, the English Navy attacked with force on August the 8th. They used long-range gunners to pummel the Spanish fleet. Now, the Spanish primary battle tactic in marine warfare at this time was to broadside an enemy and then to board their ship. So by using these expert marksmen with long-range gunners, they fired on the Spanish fleet and they sunk 11 of the 12 ships that were anchored there off the coast of Gravelines. And they incurred virtually no damage to the English ships at all. So the Armada's commander determined to retreat with many of his ships scattered and the rest sunk. He determined to retreat. Well, meanwhile, the wind had shifted to the south. So he, in charting his course, determined to sail north for a while and then to change course back to Spain. But as the fleet reached the latitude of Ireland, it encountered a large hurricane, and it was hammered by both the wind and the sea, and at least 24 ships were driven on the rocks and were broken on the Irish coast, where many of the survivors of those ships were eventually killed by Queen Elizabeth's ground troops. And the storm was referred to as the Protestant Wind. In fact, in several stories of remarkable providences in history, this story is told to show how that God protected the English nation from Catholicism and the influx, the invasion of the Spanish Armada. The storm is called the Protestant Wind. It was seen as a sign that God supported the Reformation. In fact, they struck many commemorative medals of that episode, of that event in history, with the inscription, "He blew with his winds and they were scattered." So Queen Elizabeth was seen as a Protestant champion. Now she was actually, even though she wasn't a Roman Catholic, she did have strong ties toward the Church of England. And the Church of England is not a Catholic institution. It's a Protestant institution, but it borrowed a number of traditions from Catholicism. For instance, their clergymen were required to wear vestments, or we would call them robes. They were required to wear professional garb that identified them as separate from the laity. Furthermore, they were required to make the sign of the cross at a baptism, and they were required to bow at the name of Jesus. Every time the name of Jesus was mentioned in public worship, they were required to kneel and to bow. And even though Protestantism had displaced Catholicism in England, yet there still was several traditions that reminded groups of the Protestants, like the Baptists and the Puritans, that reminded them of Catholicism. So when good Queen Bess died in 1603, the next king that would succeed her would present an opportunity for the Puritans and these Baptist groups to register their complaint and to enact several reforms that they thought were necessary. Well, it was soon learned that James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England, would be Elizabeth's successor. And the Puritans saw their opportunity to break free from the close link that had been established between the church and the monarch with James VI, for he had been very inclined toward the Reformation in Scotland. John Knox had led the Reformation in Scotland under James VI's reign, and he had instituted a more Presbyterian and less Episcopal mode of church government and relationship between the monarchy and the church. And Presbyterianism, as you know, is the idea of a group of elders governing a local congregation. Episcopalianism is the idea of one bishop governing a number of churches. And so they saw this as more of a republican form of government, and the Puritans, therefore, and the Baptists of that day favored a more Presbyterian government. And they saw James VI as their key to instituting such a greater freedom of religion. So what happened is a group of Puritan activists, when they learned that he was coming down from Scotland, they intercepted his caravan on its way down from Scotland to England to make his accession to the throne. And they presented him in 1603 with what they called a millenary petition. It was called that because it had been signed by 1,000 ministers who objected to the close relationship that existed between the Church of England and the monarch. And in this petition, they asked King James for several reforms in various major areas. For instance, they asked for the removal of the burden of human rites and ceremonies in their public worship. That is, those ceremonies that cannot be documented or established with a scriptural precedent. They asked for the removal of that burden. They also asked for the removal of the practice of making the cross at baptism, the wearing of clerical vestments, and they asked for removal of the requirement to bow every time the name of Jesus was mentioned in public worship. And they made one further request to the new king as he was coming down, even before he had been installed as the king. He was just on his way. They made one further request, and that was that the king would consider convening a conference in which learned divines would meet together to debate and discuss the need for a new English translation of the Bible. And whether or not James knew it, this last request would be the most significant of the requests that they made and the most significant of the achievements that he would make during his tenure as king, his tenure on the throne of England. In fact, may I dare say tonight, if it had not been for King James giving his assent to the production of a new English translation, which became the King James Bible, very few of us would even know that he existed and would even care about his reign on the throne of England.